Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games.
Is it?
Today, we're going to talk about our Eurus, the game that we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then we're going to talk about the games we played this week. Very small news segment. And then on to our topic, which is game design pet peeves. Mark, what did we review exactly 1 year ago?
I was, in fact, filled with a great sense of shame and regret at realizing that the Eurus is Beowulf the Legend by Reinar Knizia, because over the course of the past few months, several times I've had occasion to try to bring games for five players as a player count of varying levels of familiarity with hobby games, and I completely forgot about Beowulf the Legend, which is really weird because it's one of my top games of all time, and it's sadly underlooked even by me. It was just one of those momentary lapses of concentration, and I now feel very guilty at having forgotten about Beowulf the Legend. It's an amazing game tragically overlooked.
Yeah, not only does it play up to five, but it plays up to five very well.
Yes.
Because it's very auction-based. And I'm not saying every time, but most of the time, I believe, auction games shine the more players there are.
Often, yes. This is very much in the similar El Grande territory, both in that it is better with four or five, and also, I think, falsely identified as only being good at five. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. And generally, this is ill appreciated even amongst the Knizia Cognoscenti. No sign of it being reprinted. Nobody talks about it much anymore. But I do think it ranks amongst his very best. It's a series of auctions, as you say. So far, very much appropriate with Knizia. But it's got lovely little bits of risk and drama and varying rewards and different kinds of auctions at different times. And I think it's splendidly done. Dewey has requested that we play it. And so we'll definitely be in a position to get it to the table soon. I think it is long overdue. This game is never leaving my collection. It's a shame that I forgot about it.
Is it designated as a deck builder?
No, not even remotely.
But don't new...
You have one-shot special action cards.
Oh, they don't go back into the deck after they're
used? No.
That being said, yes. So it's an auction game where everyone's drawing off the same deck, and it has all sorts of different icons, and it's all sorts of different kinds of auctions. But if you win certain auctions, then different cards enter the... into your hand, but once they're played, then they're out.
I've forgotten
whether or not they go into the discard or out of the game.
It would have been interesting if Knizia had accidentally invented elements of deck building about 7 years before Dominion, but no, that is not what happened. Beowulf the Legend is wonderful. People, I think it is one of those games, and Knizia has a couple of games like this that is falsely identified as being too much about luck. But Beowulf is about knowing when you're in a position to engage in risky behavior, which as a Euro adaptation of a heroic epic, I think is pretty darn good.
As far as it sort of follows the theme as you're going down the track.
Yep.
You do all the sort of, you know, the typical Beowulf-y stuff.
Now, sadly, it's very much you're following Beowulf around. In that way, it's very stereotypical Euro instantiation of a theme. But time after time, I see people on the internet saying, oh, you just either pull the cards you need or you don't. It's like, no, you get to engage in risk in those circumstances where you've set yourself up in a situation and correctly analyzed that whether you succeed at the risk or not, you're fine. If you risk when you can only afford to succeed, you are doing badly and have made a bad decision, and the game will punish you for it. So Beowulf the Legend is sadly underplayed, including by me. And so I feel like I've been letting down the team. Letting down the hobby.
Well, we're going to play it this week, so... There
looks like. Looks like. So more to follow. That's Beowulf the Legend, published by Cosmos in 2005. Distributed in the US by Fantasy Flight, back when they did things like that. So, Walker, now onto the games we played last week. What did you play last week?
Well, I was lucky enough to return to some games, Mark. We streamed Terminus with Sidewinder and Warm Boy, and I am enjoying it more and more for reasons that I'm going to talk about at the end. But in Terminus, you're building this subway system and you're trying to develop areas where your subway system is because it'll get you more points. And you also have these objective cards. There's like, you know, general objective cards for the whole table. And then you have your own agendas. And so you're trying to satisfy, it's one of these games where you're trying to satisfy multiple things at the same time. You sort of like, oh, I'll put my track this way because it'll sort of hit both of them at the same time. I failed that part. I did great jobs on the cards. And then I'm just like, why do I need hubs, Mark? Hubs are sort of advanced subway stations. I don't need hubs because I don't have any cards that need hubs. And then I thought to myself, well, Mike, you just explained how endgame scoring works. And that's where hubs come in. And
oh, yeah.
Like, and then I was like, oh, yeah. Too late.
That was one of the things I actually appreciated about Terminus, in that it's a somewhat involved Euro game, medium weight, definitely. And the scoring is relatively focused. You have these objective cards and the rest is hubs, more or less. And I always appreciate it when a game can focus down to a level of simplicity at that level.
Yeah. And it's a very handcuffy game. So it is, you can only carry 8 resources. We said 10 last week, but it is only 8
oh my goodness.
On your board. But I just want to make sure, you know, we don't want to give misinformation.
No, of course. I just, oh, wow, that explains a lot about how restrictive I remember it being.
So at any time, you can only hold 8 resources. So you can't have this big buildup to do a big thing, because the big thing is putting out tracks and stations. In order to do that, you have to start off having 2 construction resources and a file resource, plus
1 blueprint per station you plan on dropping.
Plus having the track as well. So
plus you, having the track.
So, yeah, you, yeah, like, of course, so starting off the game, you're very hard, because in order to put out the stations, you have to move this marker down.
That also track, requires construction, yeah.
So you have to do so much to even start anything in this game. I'm enjoying it more and more, and it's definitely one of these games where I think your score will just get bigger and bigger as you go, because my score more than doubled this time.
Oh, wow.
And I feel as though it'll just get higher the more I play it. So part looking
of,
forward.
Part of that might also have to do with the smaller player count.
True. I think it moved a little bit better at 4.
Oh, good.
We'll see.
How did you feel the market dynamics working? Did they seem a little less arbitrary this time?
I think so.
Okay.
It really did feel that way. There was a little bit of pausing. I could saw Warm Boy, you know, try to hold back because he really wanted, you know, blueprints at a lower price. So he's like sort of hitting every spot, waiting for everyone to, because it's a fluctuating market. As you buy stuff, it gets more expensive. So, and as people use them, they go back and make
use them, not sell them. I should yeah, be worth emphasizing. Use them. Again.
They go back and make them cheaper again. So you can sort of hold back and hope people will spend said blueprints. And so everyone skipped the spot in order to spend the blueprints in order to punish Warm Boy as he needed to be punished.
Well, that's just it. I engage in that behavior as well. It's the obvious recourse. But what you're left with is just that, the hope that someone will happen to spend in such a way that you're able to profit from it. But if you're at the step prior to that resource base, if you're one step away on the rondelle and you don't have the option of delaying any longer, you have to go and do the terrible thing. And whether that's overpay for a resource, possibly even have not being able to buy it because you're too poor, or because of the weird way construction enters the system, only getting a single construction is your entire action. Oof.
Or you can just take the hit and just decide to skip it entirely and say, I'll just do it on the next round and hope on the next round that there's actually more resources.
Yeah, you delay in the hope that something will happen. And if it doesn't happen, you can then choose to double down and delay yet more if there's time left in the round. And if there's not time left in the round, well then, thanks for playing Terminus.
And played out the end a little bit differently. I remember in the first game that we played that we were right down to the last turns getting done what we wanted.
Yes.
Whereas in this game, Sidewinder and I think maybe the other two as well, there was nothing. We were just eking out the last thing. We had done our big things, and then we were just sort of like trying to get the last few points at the end with our last, you know, two or three laps. It was interesting.
Okay, then.
So Terminus is designed by Earl Apparatus and Tom Volpe.
Earl Asparus and Tom Volpe.
Published by Inside Up Games. And if you want to check it out, we streamed it. It's on our live channel and our YouTube.
So, Walker, we're on the jury for the International Gamers Awards.
We are.
And one of the nominees for solo games is For Northwood, a solo trick-taking game, because it's for solitaire. And this was designed by Will Sue, self-published, and I vaguely remembered that you crowdfunded this on the basis that it had very cute woodland animals. Yes.
Two hits, trick-taking and the cuteness factor.
Absolutely. It is very cute. It uses the plastic cards. I'm not a huge fan of plastic cards, you know, the same rough style as a lot of chip theory games use, but whatever. It is indeed adorable. I have played twice. The first time I played was with the recommended baby setup, and it felt super arbitrary. Incredibly arbitrary. Because it's a two-player trick-taking game where the other player is automated. It just, they play the top card of the deck, but they always have the lead. And so consequently, you've got your hand of cards, and you figure, well, if they lead this suit, I'm completely boned. If they lead this other suit, we'll see what happens. And here I've got a six. So if they lead 1-5, I'm all right. If not, But then again, on top of that, every round, it's kind of like bidding. It's like a bidding trick-taking game where you must make your bid exactly. And over the course of the entire game, the bids 0-7 are available off of an 8-card default hand, although the number of cards you have in hand can fluctuate by virtue of special abilities. So it's all about massaging the special abilities. That's pretty much the only agency you have, more or less, because planning for future tricks is not really a great strategy, given that the deck is so random and you don't go through the entirety of the deck in a given round most of the time. So if you need to win a certain number of tricks and they lead the card and you can beat it, best to just go for it.
So are we talking about Arcs or Northwood again? I'm sorry, I got mixed up.
Yeah, it's easy to get confused. And so the first game really left me frustrated. So the second game I played with a sort of advanced setup where you randomize the starting abilities. And there, I just felt that the abilities gave me far more control. For example, one of them was, look at the top three cards of the deck. So you put them back in the same order, but you know exactly what's going to be led and when. And so this can give you an insight as to what to slough, how to use other special abilities. It was great. I had to worry about when to use it. And it didn't immediately hand me a whole bunch of tricks, but it really helped me figure out how I was going to get to the specific bid that I had. Now, the bidding is still super restrictive. You know, if you're playing the round and you're committing to winning four tricks and you win three or five, sorry, that's as good as getting none or all. And I find that very restrictive in trick-taking games, regardless of the type. I much prefer it in a system more like Spades, where you make a bid and you're strongly incentivized to make the exact bid, but there's some wiggle room and you just get penalized a little bit for being over, not losing everything. That's a minor gripe. It is cute. I don't know how much longevity it has past the different special powers. I mean, that is indeed the primary decision point you have over the course of a round. I would like it if it were a little bit more flexible, if there were a little bit more texture to the different rounds. It felt a little bit repetitive by the end. It's a quick game, but you're just going through eight rounds of the various bids that are available to you over and over, just flipping up a card and deciding whether you're beating it, if you can. So it was all right. I enjoyed it. I don't know what else can be done with solo trick-taking, really. Like, at the point where you're playing two cards in a trick, I'm already impressed at things like Fox in the Forest, where you can make two-player trick-taking a go of it. Same thing with Sail. Albeit in a cooperative context. I think solo might be a little bit too far past what the structure can accommodate into kind of sort of a gimmicky territory. But I don't regret my time with For Northwood, and it is indeed adorable. So that is my early experience with For Northwood, a solo trick-taking game.
I return to Deep Rock Galactic, designed by Ole Stillness and put out by Mood Publishing. And I'm enjoying a little bit more of it each time I play it. It is very much a standard dungeon crawling type game, but it does a few things that are very interesting. One, it tracks ammunition. So we always, you know, a lot of times when a game tries to track ammunition, it's painful and not fun. It's not too bad in this game. And another thing this does, it's not just we're going to throw more and more monsters at you. It has like objectives that you have to complete, and you're under a time limit. So it's not so much just, you know, make it past the monsters. It's do all of these things, keep the monsters off you as much as you can, but try to get all this done in time and get back to your pod. So that is very interesting as well. And the shooting has this interesting sort of like chain it around if you can, and upgrading your weapons and stuff like that. And when you need ammo, you can, if you've mined the right minerals, you can call down a pod that has like all sorts of different ammo in it. And so you can, you know, reload your guns, of which you have two. And so it's interesting that you can track two different kinds of ammunition. So, you know, you can equal it out. You can even just pickaxe things to death if you want to sort of, you know, not waste ammunition. Anyway, still enjoying Deep Rock Galactic. Going to return to it again and see if I can get through all the missions.
Do you think I would enjoy it?
I think so. It moves at a great pace. Kind of game that scales very well with players, because it's one of the games that where at the end of your turn, you simply flip an event card.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter how many players you're playing with. So adding another player would be fine. And, you know, the movement, you know, you move around is not this restrictive movement thing anyway. And the fact that some of the map sections are completely disconnected. So you actually have to mine in towards.
Oh, that's
so
cute.
You can make these interesting connections. It's like this one's over here and that one's over there. It's like, well, I don't want to go all the way around. I'll just mine across.
That's neat. That's neat.
It's pretty neat.
It occurs to me that there are ways to make ammo more interesting that games seldom exploit. I remember the old Gears of War board game by Corey Kineska. I don't know if you ever played that. It had a pretty good ammo system. Ammo wasn't a prerequisite for every shot you did. It was instead something you could cash in to upgrade dice results after you see the result. And so it was, again, a resource to be managed, but it wasn't bookkeeping because you only tended to have a small number of ammo tokens to manage anyway. And it was something that allowed you to do cooler things rather than the thing you needed to carefully marshal and hoard so that you had any chance of doing anything in the future.
That's Deep Rock Galactic by Mood Publishing.
Played Harvest. This is basically a second edition of a worker placement game by Trey Chambers. This version is published this year by Keymaster Games pursuant to successful crowdfunding. And the crowdfunding page was very heavy on a buzzword that we've been seeing a lot lately, and that buzzword is cozy. I would not describe Harvest as cozy. In point of fact, one of Harvest's good points, I think, is that the worker placement aspect of it is tighter than the theme would lead you to believe. It's not cutthroat by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not sufficiently loose that it feels like you can just go anywhere and do anything. I did feel a pressure to get done what I needed to get done within the contours of the fact that other players were placing workers in blocking spaces. So there was that. It is, however, a very simple, very streamlined sort of borderline family weight worker placement game. And the artwork is definitely in the realm of cozy. Anthropomorphic animals, very cutesy. Not at the same level of cutesy as For Northwood, but still very much the same broad kind of pastel-colored idiom.
Is the placing of the crops, is that an actual puzzle part of the game? Or do they just look puzzly and it's pretty easy to put
a little bit. Okay, managing your farmstead and managing the space available in your farm is a big deal. Because most of your farm starts covered by woodlands. And clearing that out is difficult. And anytime you build a building, it occupies space in your farmland.
Potential growing spots.
Precisely. Potential cultivation areas. And so managing that amount of space is quite difficult in my experience. That's one of the ways in which I struggled to do well in Harvest.
Do they do some cool things where if crops are adjacent to the buildings, then they get a
bonus? Some buildings do.
Oh,
absolutely.
Neat. Okay.
Buildings do all kinds of things. Overall, I was less than impressed with how good the buildings were. Typically, what they do is they give you just a one-shot ability. Like, when you build this building, you get to do these two actions that are exactly the same as actions elsewhere on the board. So it actually just gives you a little bit more action flexibility, which is fine, but there are some buildings that at the end of the game score based on what crops are adjacent to them after all is said and done. And those were a little bit more interesting. But of course, I was going more for cashing in crops through cultivation. So it's not quite like Agricola or Nisfjord or anything like that. There's no sense of, well, now I have the field and now I get the seed and now I plant the thing. Basically, if you have a fruit or vegetable, it's either in your supply, in which case it's worth nothing, it's on your board, in which case it's worth something at the end of the game, or you harvest it and you get more points right away. And so there's a sort of dynamic of getting the stuff, putting it in, harvesting it. There's an aspect called cultivation where you throw water at it and then your crops multiply on your board. a little bit like how sewing works, but not really. And managing those resources is the heart and soul of scoring points and harvest. This all is limited by your available resources. As I said, there's water, there's money, there's also poop. They call it fertilizer. I know poop when I see it. People have called me scatological in the past. I think that's a crappy thing to say to somebody. But I've had time to digest on those comments, and it's all come out the other end, so it's just fine. And I thought that harvest did just enough. It wasn't the kind of thing where I thought, oh, this is amazing, this is making me reevaluate worker placement, but it certainly didn't strike me as generic and derivative of a lot of other also-rans in the worker placement space. And so I don't know that I'd ever suggest it ever again, but I'd be willing to play it. It moves along at a good clip. It's only four tight rounds, which is a pretty good length. It gives you enough time for a couple crop rotations, which is about as much as you'd want in a game of this ilk. And as I say, it's very charming, very cute. The mayor is Gary the Cow, G-A-I-R-Y.
Did the production value overall make it enjoyable experience to play, sort of?
So I have the deluxe version, and the deluxe version upgrades the tokens with wooden vegetables. The pumpkins in particular are quite impressive, little screen-printed strawberries, things of that nature. And yes, the components are a joy to manipulate. They're very pretty. I would have appreciated it more if there was slightly more of like a puzzle placement aspect, as you said, in terms of arranging things on a farm, within striking distance of something like a Feast for Odin, of just slotting things in a polyomino way. The farmstead isn't quite big enough, and your territorial demands aren't quite sophisticated enough to really engage that. It was more just, I have X empty spaces in my farmyard that allows me to put in so many crops. It was more at that level than anything else. And as I say, I was left a little bit disappointed because I really like Trey Chambers' design work on other games, especially his worker placement work on Arge and the Consortium, which they're really kind of at opposite ends of a spectrum, frankly. Arge and the Consortium is one of your heavier, more in-your-face, aggressive, confrontational worker placement games, whereas Harvest is very approachable, almost family weight, very friendly in nature, although there is a fair amount of blocking, but that's mostly just in terms of prioritization. So Harvest was enjoyable, it was all right, visually delightful, but it mostly gets by on charm. I'd play it again if someone wanted to, but I don't know that I would request it. That is Harvest, and for reference, I never played the first version.
We are lucky enough to get Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition to the table, and it's designed by Tom Stasiak of Beautiful Disaster Games. Now, I'm loath to call this a dungeon crawler, but it gives you that overall feel. If you want to play a dungeon crawling game but come at it at a completely different angle in every single way, then it sort of gives you that general feel of that you have a character and they get, you know, leveled up and you're fighting monsters in totally different ways. So you go through this whole sort of village segment where you're going, you know, you're traveling to different areas and you're trying to scout out what the boss is going to be that you're going to fight, you know, to help you sort of point your character in a certain direction. And you're trying to collect gold because that's what helps you level up. And you're trying not to get too much exposure from the elements. And then you fight the boss, and that, instead of, you know, the typical sort of moving your character around these, you know, dungeon spaces and doing that thing, it's completely abstract. You're moving either, you know, you're not in combat or you're engaged in this particular group of bad guys that's, you know, it's just, you have to play it. It's fantastic. Mark, I know you've never heard of it before, but what did you think of your first game?
Yeah, this is my first exposure to Assault on Doomrock. I just want to emphasize the extent to which the monsters that we fought were really interesting. So we fought the critters, which are basically just a rampaging group of bunnies and cute little woodland animals. And most of the time in Doomrock, you win after defeating the enemies. In this case, your goal was to survive for 3 rounds. And in part, this was because every round, they would spawn 12 new critters. It was just not possible to keep up with the volume of critters. But at the end of every round, the party will take extra damage based on the number of critters engaged with them. And given that they're charging you constantly, some of them drag their friends along with them. And it just doesn't matter how many activations they get. The activation system in Doomrock is basically scales with the AI deck. And the way the AI deck works for the critters is they just keep swarming you over and over and over again without legions of special rules. It's just how their AI works. And we were very accidentally well suited to this encounter by virtue, once again, of Dewey. Dewey is the Doomrock Whisperer. He figures out Doomrock in a way that I just don't understand. I remember the first time we taught him Doomrock, I'm like, look, nobody ever wins Doomrock. Winning is impossible. That's the first time I won. It was with Dewey. I also said other things to Dewey. Yeah, there's no real such thing as a support character in Doomrock, and defense doesn't really work. It's more of a mitigation strategy. And then he showed me how to be a defense support character in that game we won. Anyhow, he was a necromancer, and he reanimated a dead Jell-O, and the Jell-O managed to basically absorb us in its gelatinous bulk and drag us away from the hordes of the bunnies at the end of the round, thereby causing us to avoid the damage and squeaking out a relatively comfortable win. You don't tend to crush things in Doomrock. If you can walk away from the encounter, you've done well. And we survive pretty well. I just think that the sheer combination of interesting things that happen in terms of character builds, in terms of different skills that show up, in terms of the way the different AI works, everything is done with such a degree of attention to detail on top of, as you say, the iconoclastic, unique, abstract terrain and movement system that Doomrock has always had, and it remains one of my favorite co-op adventure-y things. Just the way that it reimagines combat, the way it reimagines all those things, is almost exactly suited to my preferences and super unique besides.
That is Assault on Doomrock.
It is worth emphasizing, though, that if you have Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition, which is the edition to get, go through the Epic Item Deck and remove the banner from Kekistan, which is an accidentally included crypto-fascist bit of imagery that is in the box by virtue of a misprint. So do your civic duty and burn it.
Next up, we are lucky enough to play Tribune. This is designed by Karl-Heinz Smiel. We played the newest Spielworks edition, and Tribune is Tribune. It's another it's a hand management game where you're desperately always trying to increase your hand size because you need cards for all sorts of different things, specifically the 10 different worker placement sections that you're going to. Usually means you have to discard a card to pick up more cards, or, you know, compete in the Colosseum, which you have to have the right cards for, or taking over all these different factions, which you have to play these sets for. So you're on the constant drive to get more cards and figuring out a way to get, depending on the player count, usually 4 different victory conditions in order to win.
Yeah, and the key aspect of Tribune that I really like is how the hand management dovetails with the direct player interaction in the form of competing for better sets to control the factions. On top of that, like for what happened in round 2, both Louis and I were going to make a play to control the Vestal Virgins. The problem was that he was earlier in turn order. And where I was in a position of having to both try to go get the cards that were available and to put my worker out so I could go try to contest the space. And I couldn't do both, and I made the wrong choice. I reserved the right to contest the space, and meanwhile, Louis was able to lock up his own influence over the Vestal Virgins. Now, I was able to come back later next round with increased resources, but that is the example of the kind of tempo manipulation that dovetails with the player competition that you seldom see in a lot of worker placement games.
Yeah, like, I was going to bring that point up too. It's like a push your luck. It's like it's very limited space to take over a certain faction. And so you have to decide whether you're going to gamble to try to get the cards, like placing your workers first to try to get the cards, or are you going to sort of hold that position so you can actually even be eligible to fight for that faction.
Yes, yeah. Yes, because by merely placing your worker there, you are broadcasting to the table your intention to contest it, which might cause everyone else in response to just go snap up more cards of that faction and beat you to the punch. Anyway, yes, you're right. The push your luck aspect, I think, is a good comparison. And this, as I always say, this re-edition, it was originally published by Heidelberger and distributed in North America by Fantasy Flight. And the Fantasy Flight one, the expansion was involved separately, and that led to some mild graphical confusion and the unfortunate tendency to often just ignore the expansion board because it's another thing off to the side. But in the prospect of harmonizing everything, the new edition has made things considerably less visually appealing and also introduced some other things that are just, they're not good or bad, they're just kind of weird. Like you mentioned the Colosseum. The Colosseum is now this new kind of pseudo-Beowulf-y kind of how long can you stay in competition, which is very different from how the rest of the game works. It feels very thorny, and it's the one thing that I never really remember how it works.
Oh, I kind of liked it. And I like how they introduce it as well, because all of the new stuff starts off blocked off at the beginning of the game. So it gives players a chance to like either relearn or, you know, get used to how the game basically works, and then you get an event card every turn that is slowly going to introduce these new parts of the game. So it gives you a chance to sort of, you know, figure out what's going on.
That's a good observation. I don't know. I guess it's just that I'm so accustomed to the other rules, and I've been playing with them for a very long time, that the new stuff just strikes me as weird. I like the new faction, the new Christians faction, that I like. Those rules, it's a lot cleaner than the other stuff. It's just the Colosseum is just one space where everything works very differently. You're playing cards in a different way. You don't lose the cards. They just stay on the table until the end of the round. It's just, I don't know. I don't mind playing the new edition, and all told, it's probably the one I'm going to stick with because it is more compact and it is more cohesive as an overall affair. I just miss some of the visual aspects of the original version, and I'm not 100% comfortable yet with how some of the new changes work.
I miss the giant chariot.
It wasn't that big, but it was nice. It was somewhere for the pro console to stay until someone claimed him.
Exactly.
Yeah, now it's just a helmet.
Yeah, kind of boring.
Yeah, it's not as good.
That is Tribune. Primus Inter Pares.
Remains my favorite worker placement game. We get to play Charioteer. This is a review copy sent to us by the publisher, designed by Matt Calkins, he of Sekigahara fame, published by GMT Games. And it remains an excellent racing game. There are so many things that racing games get wrong. Either an over-reliance on luck, it lasting too long, the wrong kind of player interaction, too much, too little. But as somebody who really likes hand management, Charioteer really is a hand management game. You know what the publicly available cards are going to be for the next three rounds. It's always your goal to make better and better sets. You're trying to hit various thresholds. You want your sets to be of a sufficient size for attack values. You want them to be six icons big to get to draw more special token goodies. And it's always, you always have this challenge to balance that against the vicissitudes of the current moment. I'm heading up to a corner. I should really play some corner movement. Ah, but I don't really want to raise my cornering skill, and the emperor wants me to attack anyway. Ah, so it's balancing those issues that I think really give a lot of texture and context for the very, very, very solid hand management. And I appreciate just dealing with this ocean of crap that the deck and my opponents are giving to me. And it doesn't overstay its welcome. I think Charioteer is really good.
Yeah. Every time we played it, everyone's enjoyed it and also always said, why don't we play this more? I actually remembered to, you know, increase my skill when I played cards this time. Because when you look at it, you just don't feel as though you're ever going to get to the end of a track anyway by the time the race ends. And you do, at least two skills usually get up to the top.
Yeah, as you start leveling up, sometimes that style of movement, that's another pressure on your hand management. It's like, oh, this set of attack cards I have isn't very good. Oh, but I get +5 every time I play attack cards. Maybe I should just play the crappy attack card set. I'll tell you one reason why I don't recommend Charioteer more often, and that is because I don't know why. It's one of those things where I really don't understand why. Maybe it's something I'm doing. I'm not sure. It's by the end of the game, people are still not reliably correctly tallying their movement capability. It's not super complicated. You start with a base value on the icon. You add to that the number of icons. You add to that your skill. And you subtract the amount of damage you have. It's that every turn. Every single turn, that is what you do.
True. Well, there's a lot of modifiers, right? There's your cards. Well, there's the number you play on your cards.
Yes.
Then you have to add all the symbols.
Yes,
then
those are the first two things.
You said all this again, but then you're subtracting damage.
Yeah,
I play a token with that or not? I don't know.
Okay, you're right. The token now, complicates that.
And now, is there a skill? Do I have my skill? Do I remember to add my skill to that total? I'm not sure. And then now, am I going around the corner?
But you're doing it every turn. That's the thing. And when you're heading around the third lap, and people are still getting it off, it makes me a little dispirited.
Gotcha.
I don't know what it is. Again, it's not complicated. It's not thorny. There are not a whole bunch of exceptions. It's a very clean and unified rule set, especially for GMT. But when you're entering the last stretch, literally, in this context, and people are still off by one or two reliably, it's a little dispiriting as somebody who tends to be the game explainer and game suggester. Because I don't want to be the one responsible for tallying up everyone's movement every turn. I don't want to be game police as well as game daddy.
Yeah, you don't want to be the person that always says, oh, 12? No, it's actually 10. No, it's actually less. It always happens to be less, right?
Oh, okay. Maybe people are just cheating.
I'm just joking.
I would not.
I think it's just always the damage people forget. Right? It's like they just want to move for, you know, as in a race thing, you always want to go the furthest, right?
But that's the other thing. Again, I don't mean to harp on this, but it just happens every time. It's not, I grant you the damage is often one of the things, but it's not that any of the factors is completely discountable, except for the base number. Base number, people don't mess up. But people miscount the number of icons, people forget to add their skill, and people forget to subtract for damage. So of the four core factors, three of them have been known to be frequently wrong. And that's not good. I don't know if this is a group thing. I should try
I think it's just the idiots you play with.
So that's Charioteer. It's probably my favorite straight racing game that we play. And it gets a lot right. Matt Calkins has done some really interesting design work, and he is definitely one of those designers. Every time he releases a game, I absolutely want to see what he's done, because his stuff is very different and tends to be very enjoyable. I wasn't a huge fan of Tin Goose. It was kind of interesting. But Sekigahara and Charioteer are fabulous designs. And those are the games we played last week. Now we're going to take a quick break to pay some bills.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. And now onto the news and why it doesn't matter. So, Walker, there was a game called Dawn of the Peacemakers.
Yes, in concept, we thought it was very interesting, but did not try it.
Yeah, I was deeply disappointed by the fundamental conceit that you were a bunch of pacifist interveners in an armed conflict, and the victory conditions seemed to be all premised around prolonging the fight so that everyone just attrited down at the same level. And I just found that it was just one of those things where conceptually I couldn't come to grips with it. I read the designer diary for the sequel called Peacemaker's Horrors of War. And for what it's worth, that objection is something that they tried to accommodate in the new design. And now it's the case that anytime a unit gets eliminated, anytime you cause units to fight each other to the point of mutual exhaustion or elimination of one of them, you get a horror of war deck. Because of the guilt of the fact that these people got eliminated, quote-unquote, under your watch. So, I think their design goals are in the right direction. I'm very curious to see how it's going to shape up. They were very much at the forefront of the anthropomorphic animals kind of trend when the first Peacemakers was done.
Just before the tidal wave started?
Yeah. And so, I'm not going to blame them for having yet more anthropomorphic animals. They've already got this universe, so there you go. So, I'm definitely going to be taking a close look at Peacemaker's Horrors of War.
Mark, we enjoy Quartermaster General, and yet another Quartermaster General game is coming out. And the name is a little odd. This is called The South Front, which seems to be, I haven't read too much into it, but seems to be the North African conflict.
I think they've called it that. Because the overall plan is to have three games in this series. East Front, West Front, and this one being South Front. So I assume that this was done for synergy purposes. Yeah.
And I guess it hits the sort of overall compass points more properly, as opposed to, you know, if you said North Africa, you'd think it would be above,
I guess. Maybe.
The West and East Front. You
that's
know?
Not really so, how that works, but I guess. Sure, sure.
In a way, if you look at a compass rondelle. Anyway, seems like an odd
title. For those of you listening at home, Walker has twisted his arms into a precise configuration that would not be out of place. In
like
some
if I was doing charades and I did this, you would say compass rose, right?
sure, Walker, sure.
So yes, odd name, but we'll definitely play because I've played all of them and it's World War II, which I enjoy. Quartermaster General, South Front.
Still in World War II, the Valiant Defense series was a series of solo war games designed by David Thompson, published by DDG. And there is a new entry into the Valiant Defense series on crowdfunding right now called Guadalcanal, The Battle for Henderson Field. This was not designed by David Thompson. Now, you might say, oh, why am I emphasizing this? That's because the designer's name is not mentioned anywhere on the crowdfunding page. In point of fact, Pavlov's House, the first published game in the Valiant Defense series, is mentioned more often than the designer of Guadalcanal. So, in case you, like me, get email updates from every company to whom you've ever given the slightest bit of attention on crowdfunding, I thought, ooh, I didn't know that David Thompson had a new Valiant Defense game coming out, and went on the campaign page, and I just got more and more confused based on their refusal to acknowledge who was involved in the design of this. David Thompson's not involved. I'm not particularly interested as a consequence. I won't be backing it. The graphic design work by Niels Johansson is beautiful. But the designer is, in point of fact, Vincent Cooper. He's done some design work on some of the Warfighter supplements in the past. So, look, I don't have anything against Vincent Cooper. I'm just saying, if David Thompson's not involved, I'm not particularly interested in this instantiation of the Valiant Defense series. Go play Pavlov's House. It's wonderful.
And that's the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to the topic for the week, which is game design pet peeves.
This is an opportunity for you to vent some spleen, Walker.
I'll be venting all of the spleen.
No, you only get to vent your spleen.
Oh.
When you're venting other people's spleen, that means something else, and that's bad. So what is it? What is it that angers you? What is it that gets under your skin?
Well, this I was thinking about this, it's just because it's so different for so many people, right?
Absolutely.
Because what I hate, some people love.
It's true. And this often, it isn't even just overall designs that you
no, it's like. It's particular just
very
parts.
Yeah.
And where you just sort of, you sit there for a second, and then my hand goes out, and Mark knows very well I'm looking for the rule book, because I felt that this particular, just, it doesn't seem right. There's no way that this game I'm enjoying has suddenly took a 90-degree turn, and now we'll go into the bonfire of death.
So we're all, well, actually, that's an interesting question. Are all of these deal breakers for you? Because these aren't deal breakers for me. These are things, I've got a lot of pet peeves, and it's like, I wish I didn't do that. But I can still have this in a game that I enjoy.
At that particular moment. It is. But then, you know, I think about it and I see how it sort of flushes out by the end of the game.
Uh-huh.
And I understand why they did certain things certain ways.
Or you're willing to forgive it by virtue of other excellent things that it does.
Just so.
I'm not saying that you necessarily have to come to terms with any of these things. You never have to defend any of these decisions. I'm just saying that looking over a variety of my pet peeves, some of my favorite games have these things. It's just they do other things so well that I'm willing to take it as an overall package. So what do we got, Walker?
Let's just start with deck milling.
Okay. Right? Why don't you give a definition about what deck milling is?
Well, there's a couple of games. Let's talk about like Dead of Winter and or Police Precinct, where you're asked to go to certain locations, and in order to sort of succeed at that location, you need certain cards out of a deck. And it's just shuffled. It's not going to be in the top half. It's going to be somewhere in the deck. Or maybe you have a certain wizard that needs a certain type of spells.
So, he's talking about spirits
no,
and powers.
You're not playing a wizard in Mark in Spirit Island. You're playing gods.
You're not playing gods in Spirit Island either. You're playing spirits.
Spirits.
No. It's relevant for the thematic coherence of the brilliantly textured, lovely world of Spirit Island. Whose joys you're utterly blind.
I'm talking about wizards.
You're talking about wizards. Okay, tell me more about these wizards.
Right, so you go to these locations, and in order to get those items out of the deck, you have to sort of play cards or do things that constantly lets you draw cards and work through that deck until you find the cards that you need. And I hate that.
So I think we can emphasize, to me at least, I find it illuminating to gesture to some games that might be superficially similar, but don't do that thing. And one...
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So I have games that do well.
Okay, go ahead.
Or I have a game that does it well. I feel Shadow Rift is the same sort of thing. They have their main deck where you have the rifts shuffled in and you have to get through that deck because you have to close the three rifts.
Right.
And so in a way you're milling through it, but you're going gradually through that deck anyway.
Yeah.
But there are ways that will allow you to go through it faster.
It's not that you're looking for particular kind of matches.
That's right.
Instead, you just know that this is the timer deck and we need to burn through it as best we can.
Just so.
Yeah. The example I was going to give was a recent game that in hindsight, I wasn't thinking about it in these terms at the time, that I'm actually somewhat pleased that you enjoyed, which is Starship Catan the Duel. Because there you have these location decks and they are shuffled, but they're never very big. And every time you pick a certain sector you're going to go, you pick the location deck, and then you start revealing cards off of that at a certain time, and you have a certain distance you can go and a certain number of actions you can do to interact with those cards. There, at least, as the game progresses, you get to see more and more of each sector every time you go through, and it's more of like a memory element slash press your luck than
it is deck
milling.
I was about to say, it plays off as a press your luck element, so it doesn't feel as bad as these other games that I've had experiences with.
Yeah. I still don't. I wish I could remember the specific things that happened in those early plays of Spirit Island you had for you to decide that it's a deck milling game.
Yeah,
I just don't.
And then just became a bit. So
yeah, I know. I know. Okay. At this point, we're too far gone. It's too much of a bit. There are enough people that love Spirit Island. They get to have their Spirit Island yayas out, and you have other things to play. It's not worth trying to rehabilitate it in your eyes. But here we are. I don't mind deck milling so much if it is joined with some kind of hand management or mitigation elements. I mean, my principal beefs about Dead of Winter are elsewhere. Like, you and I both really strongly dislike Dead of Winter, but for me it was a lot of other stuff. And, yeah, I do at least see where you're coming from when it comes to deck milling. What else you got, Walker?
Starting player. So sometimes we, you know, go through the rules of a game, and it will just say, you know, give a starting player randomly.
Right.
Period. And then we sort of look at the board and it'll be like, this is a worker placement, right?
Yep.
And so as the first player, I get to go wherever I want and there's no sort of system. Usually they give, you know, extra money to the other players or like even in Terminus, it's the same sort of thing. You can go anywhere on the rondelle. Now there is a system where you're given two cards and there's supposed to be this sort of, you know, you're giving up a card because it has a lower number that you're discarding, and apparently,
yeah, that
has,
seemed very attenuated.
This is what I mean.
Yeah.
So that it seems arbitrary, and yet it's still giving you an advantage as first player. And so I wish they had done that better.
I find that, generally speaking, game designs attempt to mitigate star player advantage, at least with something. Like, for example, with Tribune, you get one extra dollar for every space you're down. And there are usually enough valuable spaces that in the case of something like Tribune, it tends to shake out. Some games are more successful at this than others. I'm not going to say that it's always done very, very well. The thing that I find less frequently acknowledged, at least, is within the turn order, not even start player, but just within the turn order. So, for example, a couple of games that come to mind. One of them is For Sale. Where you are in the overall seeding of For Sale is hugely determinative based on when the flop is. If the flop of properties is very tightly bunched, you don't care where you're sitting. It doesn't matter. Being first is actually fine. You can just pass and take the lowest value when it ain't no thing. But if it's the case that there's a huge gulf, you know, somewhere right in the middle, you want to be the last player real bad. Like, you want to hope that the bidding is going to be driven up so that someone else passes first and you don't want to be the first out.
True. And in games like For Sale and other games like that where there's so many rounds, right, it tends to just wash out anyway.
I don't know, man. There's like five rounds in For Sale. Look, this is too much of a beef for a lightweight filler game,
yeah,
right?
But I mean, but other games like that where there's tons of rounds and there is no sort of rule for first player, but there's so many rounds that it sort of first player moves around so much.
Sure.
That it might
well,
not matter.
Let me give a good example of another game that doesn't do it as well as I wish it were in. It's one of my favorite games, and that's Beowulf. So the way that it works is in the clockwise auctions, it doesn't really matter that much where you're sitting. It's not a huge deal. The simultaneous bid auctions, though, the values are so coarse that their ties are frequent. Ties are broken clockwise from the start player. The start player is whoever went last in the previous auction. Whatever. That's fine. The issue is not who gets to be start player. The issue is whether or not you happen to be sitting to the right of the start player or to the left of the start player, and you had nothing to do with that. And that can be huge in the very, very consequential auctions. It drives me batty, and it's something that even someone as talented and accomplished as Reiner Knizia does. I just, very often, and it's hard. Look, I remember the first time I played Kalos, which is the first game that I remember having a robust set of, no, it's not just who the star player is. We're going to play in a very specific order. And it does increase the length of time that the game takes, and people get confused and don't remember where they are in the turn order, and it just causes lots of delays. And sometimes some games don't accommodate for that kind of structure. I completely understand. But it just drives me nuts how a lot of attention is paid to first player, and very seldom is as much attention paid to who's sitting to your right and left.
Agreed. Next up is a catch-up mechanism. Let's talk about a game that we just played, Charioteer. Technically, none. It has a very simple and effective catch-up mechanism where the chariot that's out in front can't use a certain mechanism called whipping, which doesn't come up terribly a lot. You have to have a certain card or you have to have a certain token in the right color, but you're not allowed to use it, which gives you a ton of movement if you're in first place. And I think that's just a great way. A little bit of a catch-up mechanism, but doesn't really influence the game too much.
So what's your pet peeve?
Just games that do it terribly.
Could you give me a for instance?
No.
Okay. The example that I'll give is Power Grid. Power Grid's very blunt with its player ordering catch-up mechanism. The problem is that in Power Grid, who is quote-unquote winning is not really, because it's all about how many cities you're powering in the last round. And if you're powering no cities in the middle because you've got enough cash and you need it, the game says, oh, you're not doing so well. Let me give you a tremendous amount of advantages. Now, I realize that I'm mischaracterizing the design intent, right? I don't think that mechanism is actually there as strictly as a catch-up mechanism, and someone is abusing it by manipulating that aspect. It just rubs me the wrong way. It just irks me.
Next up is a setback or miss your turn. I think this is the one that hits me the hardest, is when you have, say, you know, in a game that's handcuffing you, it makes it very hard to get resources or hard to get something, and there's either a take that card or a certain action. It's like, I spent four turns to get these resources. Someone plays one card or takes one action and takes those resources away. So not only do they have the resources now I have to take another four turns to get them back again. And so I've literally missed eight turns now of the game.
I don't even really care how many it is. I've got this on my list as well. And lots of games that I really like have this element as well. The stun, the discard a card, the miss a turn thing, whatever. We've internalized, we've known this for decades, that player elimination is bad. But in many cases, a lot of these things are kind of like player elimination in the miniature. Skip a turn is bad. We all know that. So instead of we'll just have them discard a couple cards, like, well, what are you doing? It's the same thing. The problem isn't necessarily the scale. It's that it's unfun and you're pulling somebody out of being able to do the thing. Giving me more reasons not to do the thing is not ideal. It's why I bounced off of X-Wing the miniatures game, because very often proper play is about denying your opponent the ability to do anything. I don't like winning a game like that. I don't like losing a game like that. We were playing against a monster in Primal the Awakening, where a lot of what the monster AI does is cause you to discard cards. It's a card-driven game. No thanks. The only game that matters has stun tokens. I hate those stun tokens. And every time they come up in Seal Team Flix, I'm like, ugh, the thing I hate about Seal Team Flix. And this is, again, like Beowulf's turn order problems, is the classic example of something I loathe in a game that I really, really enjoy.
Next up, I have limited goal spots. What I mean by this is, like, back to Terminus, because I just played it. When you have those project cards, only two people can score those project cards.
Yeah.
And so you're going to be putting lobbyists there sometime during the game. So you could be working towards it, and then someone starts one of the lines and only one other person can go there. And someone might see them go there and say, oh, I better start that, even though they have nothing towards that. But you've been working towards the whole game. And a lot of games have that sort of thing where only one person can score this particular thing, or there's one card there that you have to take in order to score that. And so,
well, it's like Tribune, but in Tribune, if you get frozen out of the ability to get the faction in round two, try to get them in round three or four. In the context of limited endgame victory spots, they tend to lock up and that's it. You're done.
Exactly.
Yeah. Less good. There you have to be really confident that you're not going to get messed over due to arbitrary tempo things, like turn order, as an example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Next up, I have limiting movement in a weird way. And so we have something like Kemet, that you're always equal distance from everything. Or you have games that, you know, it's like Marco Polo, where it's just a slog to move anywhere. Or, you know, it's just this constant handcuffing of trying to get around a map or a board, or makes for very unfair, uninteresting gameplay.
Yeah, I'll disagree about characterizing Marco Polo as falling victim to that, but I can see where you're getting at. It is very expensive and difficult to move from place to place in The Voyages of Marco Polo. But I agree with you, and it's very hard, even sometimes in racing games, to make movement sufficiently fluid, but at the same time sufficiently difficult to make it worthwhile. I mean, I think the one game that comes to mind that does restrictive movement very, very well is Mage Knight. Getting from point A to point B is very difficult in Mage Knight, but nonetheless, it doesn't make me frustrated in the way that a lot of other games do. Like, for example, that time we played Beast, and we're like, okay, I discard a card to move. Oh, you're all the way the other side of the map now. Okay, great, let's start schlepping over there. Same thing with Nemesis. One of the things that we hated about Nemesis was just that, oh, you have your hand of cards, I guess I'll just be moving like I always do, wandering around, stumbling in the dark for trying to find my victory condition. I agree with you. To me, it brushes up against the sort of skip a turn, discard a card, missing out on the turn. It's like, let me do a thing. Let me do the interesting thing. This kind of dovetails with something on my list, which I talk about all the time, which is when the fun move is at odds with the smart move, right? So thinking about Nemesis, just because I was talking about it, you have these victory conditions. There's a lot of fun things you can do in Nemesis. Try to go cobble together a flamethrower so you can fight off an alien. Go try to kill the alien eggs while the actual deadly aliens are away. Mess up with other people's plans and try to be secretive and sneaky or suspicious, or try to play around with people's suspicions. Or you could try to pursue your victory conditions by just moving from point A to point B. Meh.
Yeah.
And this is how a lot of skirmish and battle games fail as well, because a lot of them don't provide you with enough impetus for action. Not enough reason to go and take the thing and make things up.
I can have fun and shoot these machine guns that I just got out, or I can take the objective that I'm supposed to take.
And just sit there. Yeah. Again, that's one of the things that Kemet does really well. Kemet has a bias towards action. You win points not as much by holding dirt, more by fighting. And so you're encouraged to go out and do the thing rather than Warhammer Underworlds did that as well, too. You know, rotating series of objectives. There's a lot of ways to do it. But make sure that the fun thing is the smart thing whenever possible.
Next up, I have onboarding too much information. And sometimes even onboarding a ton of information in your personal space. Like, I love Orleans, but it sort of does this where you can build all these different buildings and they go into your personal space so no one really knows what's going on.
Mm.
Terminus does it the other way, where you're getting all these different developments that give you new actions, but at least they go on the main board where people can see and actually put lobbyists there to take those actions as well. A lot of games have this, where you have stuff in front of you that gives you new stuff to do, and now it's just constantly being introduced as the game goes on, and you're trying to keep track of all of the stuff that people have in their own personal area, and sometimes it just becomes too much.
One of my personal pet peeves, which is very closely related to that, is games with interaction that give you a false sense of who is winning. I hate the inevitable whining that pops up in a lot of multiplayer conflict games. They're winning, go after them. No, but I'm not really winning. If you stop and pause to make the calculations, I'm not actually, and back and forth and back and forth. So, for example, in Terminus, it works really well, because for one thing, there's not as much of that interaction, but also all the scoring is at the end of the game. There's no misleading score track. Very often, games have misleading score tracks. Some of your points are being tracked there. And like, well, I might as well go attack the person who's sitting on 35 points instead of 32. But it's like, oh, but did you calculate the 50-point endgame bonus that they've already socked in? It's like, nah, I'm going to go after you because you're in the lead. I am not, in point of fact, in the lead. It's one of the reasons why I like Cosmic Encounter. Cosmic Encounter is as blunt as you can get. I'm sitting on 4 foreign colonies. Can't nobody tell me that that doesn't mean you're winning.
So some of these things, I just sort of looked down our trade list and said, why am I getting rid of these games? Or games that I enjoy, but why don't I want to play them anymore?
Right.
So one of them was Bullet. I loved Bullet. Why don't I want to play Bullet? And I feel as though maybe the real-time element is just slightly too long. We've played a lot of games lately where they have timed elements, but it's just like a short 2-minute thing, like Project Elite. It's just 2 minutes. You're doing real time and the rest is sort of strategizing and other things, or Wilmont's Warehouse, where it's just like the last part of the game is timed. And maybe just Bullet's real-time element goes on for too long, too much stress for too long.
Yeah, it's interesting. That dovetails with another interesting question. This isn't one of my pet peeves, but some people have very strong preferences between, on the one end, timed games where you're meant to run out of time, like Project Elite most of the time, or on the other end, games like Millennium Blades, where it's timed, but the timer is just there to make sure you don't take too long. And generally speaking, it's pretty common in many rounds to look left, look right. There's a minute left on the timer, but everyone's done, so you move on. And so some people have very strong preferences there, but it's just a difference of a philosophy about how to employ timed elements.
So the next one I have up is mostly, you've already sort of talked about it. The one where you didn't like X-Wing because your constant mission was just to handcuff the other player. And I felt...
Well, sometimes, depending on the build. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I felt that in Why Don't I Like City of the Great Machine? Because if you're playing the bad guy, you're just constantly making the game unhappy for the rest of the players. It's like, you know, you can't move there, or it costs you too many actions to move there. You don't have that special ability anymore. You're just constantly handicapping them over and over again.
Yeah, and contrast that with another sort of kind of hidden movement game, Sniper Elite, where there's a much greater sense of fluidity, even in the context where the net is tightening and you've really managed to corner the sniper, the game still moves along at a good clip and there's still a sense of fluidity and dynamism so that you don't have the sort of same grinding attrition that you often have in games like Beast and games like City of the Great Machine that caused us to bounce off them, yeah.
Next up I wrote down layered rules. I'm just not sure if I can word this properly. So like in a dungeon game where, or in if you have units on a map game, where there's multiple movement rules, say, movement, or just multiple rules for different types of units in different circumstances. Oh, you want to move there? Well, you're that unit, so you can only do this. Oh, it's in snow, so now you can only do this. You know, like, it just bogs down several dozen different rules for only the movement part of a game.
Okay. Yeah, I guess what we're really getting is that for us, we're very picky about how movement is modeled.
Well, it's not necessarily movement either. It's just multiple things. It's like, oh, you want to shoot? Well, you know, are you in the sand, or are you behind something? Or, you know, it's like when
then I guess I don't understand, because we like unit asymmetry.
We do, but like, it's just when you pile on too much.
Fair enough. That's fair. I have somewhat relatedly back when I thought you were talking primarily about movement. I'm tired of counting squares. I'm like, movement allowances past 3, I have a strong dispreference for. Claustrophobia showed me that you can do a skirmish adjacent thing with movement values of 1 and 2. And at this point, honestly, I'm willing to make exceptions. I still adore Space Hulk. You spend a lot of time in Space Hulk counting out the 12 square range for Overwatch. I do not enjoy that part of games anymore. There's one actually that's very, very specific and very minor, and I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it yet. Blank back of rulebook covers.
Oh,
hate that.
Or cards that have blank spaces where they could have put, you know, more rules.
I don't know. At that point, the text... Sometimes the text just gets too small. Like, you, in terms of graphic... Okay, so the thing about not putting information on the back of your rulebook, that I think everyone should do. But there's another one that's very, very personal to Walker in terms of graphic design. I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it.
Well, I thought we're just, you know, I do have some other things, but I thought we're just sticking with sort of like design parts of games, not so much like graphic.
I just want
design.
People to know how much you complain when a game has its own name on the on the card backs.
Yes.
You complain every time that comes up. It disgusts you on a fundamental level.
It does, because why? Well, because now you've made it so, you know, that you can see when the cards are boxed and they're not like...
Yeah, look, they have the graphic assets available and...
I can remember what I'm playing. I don't need to be reminded. Especially the back of the rule book. Like, can you not at least just put like a turn summary there, or icons with definitions? Something.
I don't... unlike some people, I don't insist that a rule book start with the 2 or 3 pages or even half a paragraph or whatever of this is what all the components look like. I don't think you have to do that necessarily. You can show them, you can introduce them as necessary. But I am now sick to death. I see it all the time, especially in a lot of Kickstarters, where it is never shown what kind of card is what. So you can tell me to shuffle the threat deck, the action deck, the time deck, whatever. And here I am flipping back and forth, trying to figure out what on earth that looks like. And the proportion of time where it's just never there is shocking.
Well, that's why there's a game on the shelf that I have not gone back to. Brand new, the Temple of Horrors dungeon crawling game with a dexterity element.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know, you need to do this with this deck and that with that deck. They will not tell you what the deck looks like. They'll tell you specific cards to pull out. But
yeah. What if, Walker, they get to keep putting the name of the game on the back of cards, but they have to label the back of the deck with specifically what kind of deck it is? Are you okay with that?
That would be fine.
Okay. That sounds like a good compromise. Yeah, and look, I understand the fact you've got this game, you've got all this lovely art. You don't want to mess it up with words or something like that. But the nightmare version of this was Darkest Dungeon, which had other design problems. But there was about a dozen different kinds of card decks. The card backs were very similar to each other. They could have just labeled them. They could have just put the frickin' word of the kind of card that it was on the back of the card.
I think the way to like explain this, just so you get a grasp of what these cards... Let's pretend there was these two giant doors, and there's a red room on the other side of these doors. Now, depending on how much the doors were open, that would tell you what deck it was. So are they slightly open? Is the line down the center a little bit bigger?
How much light bleed is there?
Yes. Oh, it was that bad.
It was pretty bad.
How about elaborate mechanisms for things that don't have that much impact? Like there's this sort of whole sideboard, side mechanisms, whole mini games that are going on that literally have hardly any impact on the game itself.
Yeah, historical wargaming.
Yes.
This weird thing happened in 1965, and so we have to have an entire subset of rules to cover that possibility. Yeah. It happens.
Repetition loops. I tend to be going back to Terminus a lot with things that I don't like, but still love the game.
Sure.
So like we've already talked about in Terminus, your main action will be putting out track and station. So you do that, and then you start the loop again. You're going around the board, collecting resources and getting more track. Mm. And then you do the big action again. And then you start the repetition again. So it's the game where you're just constantly doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, that actually rubs up against something that is one of my pet peeves, which is artificial scarcity. If that drives a lot of the game, I tend to tune out. That's one of the things I had against Terminus. It's the artificial scarcity of your resource limit. I'm not suggesting that every game should have unlimited resources, but what I'm suggesting is that the fact that you have an arbitrary cap shouldn't be driving so much of the tempo. The fact that I can't carry more than 3 blueprints in my satchel is doesn't... First of all, it's thematically incoherent, but anyway, set that aside. Well, in my experience...
Your satchel's full of safety cones, Mark. Of course you
exactly. There's no room for blueprints. You've got them all in safety cones. But setting aside the thematic incoherence, Terminus wouldn't work if you had, say, 20 spaces available for resources. The game would cease to function. And so consequently, a lot of what is driving Terminus as a game is just this artificial resource limit.
Agreed.
I have a pet peeve that is unresolvable. That is completely unresolvable. I think that's a good way to stop it, a good way to close it out, just to emphasize how unreasonable I am, which is a good way to end any conversation, I find. And that is that there are people in this world that have very strong opinions in both directions about whether initiative should go high to low or low to high. And I hate the fact that anytime any game has initiative rankings or priority values, Terminus does this too. This is the special Terminus episode. You then have to be like, it's resolved in priority order. What does that mean? Is 2 higher or lower priority than 15? Look, it's no one's fault. Granted, there are less and more clear ways you can phrase it in the context of your rules presentation. That's fine. Maybe there's a graphical indication you could give next to the number. Maybe some kind of bar to indicate whether it's a good number or a bad number so you can remember. Whatever. And what's terrible is there are so many people in the world, game designers and gamers as well, who very firmly believe that their way is the right way, and anybody who disagrees is clearly insane. I have no dog in this fight.
I think they should double down and make the font bigger and smaller. So it's completely... It's like, wait... Does a bigger font and a lower number mean? Just to make it completely confusing.
Yeah, sure. Again, I don't think there's an easy solution here, but it's just a pet peeve of mine that any time that there's a priority or initiative system in any game, whether it's a conflict game or a Euro game or whatever, you always then have to wonder about whether it's low to high or high to low.
Yes.
It's a shame. And I blame people who invented numbers. I think it was invented by some dude named Decimus about, I don't know, 100 years ago or so, a long time ago.
Yeah, like, I don't understand why we have it in the first place. It's only board games. If they just cut out numbers, because we don't use numbers anywhere else, so just, yeah.
I find this very compelling. Do you have a pamphlet of some kind that I could consult?
I do.
That's great.
It's a new religion I'm starting. Numbers are dumb.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you for spending the time. We appreciate it a great deal. We hope to see you again soon. Please do take care of yourself, take care of your hobby, and thank your rules explainer.
If you like this episode, tell a friend.
Peace! And also, what's wrong with you? You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.